gonna rock these shades, gonna scream my name, make you shout now, honey, gonna make you shout.
Whether you're an independent artist looking to take their career to the next level, or you're a fan that just loves to discover new artists and new original music, Making a Scene has exactly what you're looking for. For the indie artist, we have articles on music business, gear reviews, recording techniques, and interviews with industry professionals. For the fan, we introduce you to new artists every day with our in-depth artist interviews and insightful CD reviews. Nobody gives you more. Making a Scene truly is the number one resource for the indie artist and the fans that love them. Go to makingascene.org and become part of the indie revolution.
Thank you. and the kingdom is hidden in the hills. Annabelle Lee had a beauty as pure as the fresh fallen snow. One of many in her family, give or take a dozen or so. Times were hard, but it was harder for those who stood out from the rest. Taken too often, but she knew to keep her story to herself. Cause no one would listen, cause no one could hear. Shame silenced the voices, pain hid all the tears. There's simply no justice when the ruler. The kingdom is hidden in the hills. The mines. At 12 years old, she was sold to the agents who sought out her kind. Trafficked by train to the deep, remote coal camp, a comfort girl. The hollers held her secret, but she knew to keep her story to herself. When the ruler is fear, and the kingdom is a company store.
Was Mary Hot from her brand new release, and we got Mary on the line right now. Hey, Mary, how you doing today?
I'm doing great, thanks.
Now, you know, this is the first time you've come on our show, and we always like to give our fans the opportunity to get to know who you are as an artist, and the best way to do that is to look at your journey. What brought you to this point in your life? So give us the story of Mary Hot.
Yeah, I was born and raised in West Virginia, and you know, in a fairly, well, very rural area, and very small town. And you know, my entire early music was in the church, of course, which was, you know, I would say most, you know, singers relate back to that. You know, it was a small Methodist church, and was in a choir at age four, you know, singing in front of people. So singing in front of people was just sort of always in my blood. And, you know, expected to take piano lessons from an early age, which I did, and grew up in the church doing that, and, you know, playing for services and then adding guitar. So, you know, it wasn't until I graduated high school that I went into, I was, my first year of college was as a music major, a piano major, but I went off to New York City and, you know, at 19, and really immersed myself in jazz. I was, my friends, my, you know, community of people that I had moved to New York with were jazz musicians, and the musicians I got to know there, some were down in the East Village doing other things, a lot of performance artists and stuff, but most of my performing was jingles and studio. I mean, this is, you know, I'm an older musician, I'm an older woman now, and this was the early 80s, and, you know, so I was doing, you know, the way jingles used to be, or doing even studio backup singing was, you know, you didn't have retakes, and
right.
You know, they would bring me in and because I could, sing something in a wide range of keys when, because there wasn't any way to transpose. I mean, maybe there was, but it wasn't easy back then. You just sang in whatever key. So,
oh, yeah, tape wasn't cheap back then.
No, and the process wasn't cheap, and studio hours were not cheap. So, so it was a whole different world. So that's a lot of, coming from West Virginia and that dose of music, there was always sort of swing music in my blood, also, besides the gospel. There was a black church across the street from where I lived growing up. I would just sit and listen to their music because loved it, It really rocked. But, that sort of forms the picture of my, music is, I dip into jazz once in a while. I mean, we all improvise, you don't have to play jazz to be an improviser, right? And I did move to Boston after New York and spent quite a few years in Boston, and that's when I really got into the blues community, was there. It was more of an R&B, soul review, blues kind of a couple different bands in Boston. So, but then I moved back to West Virginia. So I'm back in West Virginia now, and picked up on country swing, blues, and jazz still. So I would say it's all in there wrapped together.
Well, I'm kind of an older musician myself, and I grew up in an era, listening to FM radio in New York, and genres were not a thing. Really, you had two basic genres when I was growing up, and that was AM and FM. That was how you differentiated what you listened to. I would listen to WNEW in New York, and I would get the Moody Blues, and then you'd hear Muddy Waters, then you'd hear Simon and Garfunkel next to Led Zeppelin and Black Sabbath, it was more eclectic. I think people listened, they enjoyed that diversity.
I know exactly what you mean. When I was in high school, even though I was far out in the country, we did get, I talked my mom into hooking up cable. When cable TV came through, someone told me I could hook the cable up to my stereo. And then I had album format FM, DC radio stations. So that was huge for me. Just that same world that you're talking about, I was like 15 before that world opened up to me. So, it was big.
Now, every musician has that crossroads moment, that moment where you're faced with that decision in life, whether to become an accountant or a musician. What was that moment for you?
Interesting. Well, I feel like I was raised to be a musician. I went off, like I said, to college to be a musician. And I think at that time, being in college as a musician meant you were going to be a music teacher the rest of your life. And that's sort of why I sort of made this gut decision to just run to New York and be there. But you know what happened? And I can't say this was a good thing. I mean, I guess it was good in a sense. While in New York, and some of the jazz musicians I worked with who were much older than me, like really seasoned jazz pros, were so, they were in their 60s then and struggling to survive. And I was I don't want to feel like I'm surviving all the time. And so I sort of made this decision to, play it safe and, got this software degree. And, and unfortunately, I let that take over too much of a chunk of my life. It was great that I could buy equipment and I could, survive without paying, a lot of dues time. But at the same time, I probably wish I had not quite gone so far into the safety zone. So it was that point, you know, when I had worked in the high tech industry for a while, and then had my first, you know, I had two babies, and I was looking at life going, what am I doing? I think becoming a mother, or a parent, you know, a father even, you know, changes your perspective again. And that's when I started delving back into music, you know, and making the shift back and left high tech. So probably not the answer you expected there, but
no, I mean, everyone has a journey in their life, and everyone gets to that moment, you know, whether it was initially or maybe even down the road. But that moment always happens where you have to make that decision. And, you know, having yourself financially secure while you're making that decision is probably a easier way to make the decision. You know?
True. Yeah. Yeah. It's true.
All right. Well, let's talk a little bit about this particular release. You know, every artist has something in their mind that they're looking to achieve when they put together a new project. What was your goals for this?
Well, my goals for this particular project were very different from before. I'd been living back in my home state of West Virginia for a few years, and I had heard about these stories coming out of southern West Virginia in the former coal camp areas that were not being believed because they sounded so horrific, you know, that what people struggled through, and especially what women had struggled through, that no one ever heard of before. And so people didn't want to believe it. You know, they didn't want to believe that this could have happened to our people in our state. You know, and I just felt like this was right before the Me Too movement, by the way. It just felt like there was, how can you not believe, you know, just because, you know, something seems like, oh, there's no documented records of it, or there's no court cases, you know, things happen to people and they keep it hidden. You know, I mean, I from my own family, you know, I know this, like, people keep things hidden. You don't talk about that. You know, you don't talk about this.
Right.
And so I was just so enthralled with it that I started researching more, started exploring, started, like, making visits down into that area. And you know, at first it was just that I was fascinated with the topic and the fact that no one was believing it. And then it was like, it suddenly took on, like, felt like the voices or the stories were calling to me to, like, you know, help it be heard. And that's about the point when I started, like, thinking I should write songs. I mean, I should write a song, you know, songs about this and based on these stories. And then it took me over a year of fighting myself, like, no, this is the subject matter is too painful, or the subject matter is too dark, or that, you know, and then I would jump back into it, and then I would leave it again and jump back into it. So there for a while I was struggling with the topic. And then it started forming, and I knew I was on the right path. I mean, I knew that it was something that I needed to complete. So.
Okay. Now, you know, every songwriter has their process in finding lyrics and finding melodies. And it always intrigued me on how writers find their melodies. You know, some like to use a groove. Some allow the lyric to kind of suggest where the melody should go based on its meter, consonants, and vowels. What's kind of your go-to that allows you to find your melodies?
Well, fascinating question, because in this CD or this album was all of those. There's one song that I'd never experienced this before, but it was this woman's story. It was in writing. Someone had interviewed her. She was in her 80s at the time they interviewed her, and it was just the way she spoke. There's something about the meter of the way her story flowed that, I mean, the melody just appeared. The melody appeared, and the rhythm of it, it just had never had that happen before. So that was one song, came about that way. Another song, I had the theme of it, or all of these were, there was some other people's stories, basically, that I sort of had to condense or distill almost into poetry, right? Because they're, stories that you couldn't, you could have written it like the Edmund Fitzgerald kind of, writing and singing it, in full verse, but I didn't want to do that. I, distilled it into concepts almost. And then from that, a couple of them, I just knew that I wanted it to have sort of a slightly dark but a driving kind of blues underpinning to it. And that, and then approached it from there. And then the melody formed. So it was all, really, each song had its a different approach.
Okay. One of the things I think trips up a lot of young songwriters is that moment where you need to put the pen down, where you need to say, okay, this is finished as far as I can go with the writing phase. Now, we know songs always evolve. The more you play them, they kind of evolve into what they become. But you have to get to that moment where you put that pen down and say, it's time to move it into production, time for me to take it out on the road, whatever the case may be. What do you do to determine that moment in a song's life?
That's when my intuition and the whole spirituality of writing for me come and performing comes together. The only time I feel it's ready is when I can perform it, whether I'm using guitar or keyboard, either one. But if I can perform it just with me, and nothing strikes me as glitchy anywhere, or that it just has this, underlying groove and connection to it. And I can't even really explain any more than that what I mean by that. But I always sense it. I sense something's not quite right.
Right. A lot of songwriters that I talk to, they say that when you strip it down to an instrument and a vocal, that if it doesn't go over in that context, then all the production that you put into it is not going to make that change. You know what I mean?
Exactly. Unless it's just a dance groove, and that's all it was ever intended to be.
Right, right. Well, that's a different kind of song, right?
Exactly.
Now, a lot of songwriters have embraced technology as a tool in their writing, whether it's their cell phone or they have a home recording studio, or in your case, if you play keyboards, you have certain synthesizers or sounds within, that you can help break the writer's block and bring you into a new place. What tech tools do you use technology-wise in your writing?
Not much. My cell phone is my secretary. If I'm somewhere and I have an idea that just strikes me, whether it is a line of a lyric or even a concept or a groove or some combination above, I whip out my cell phone and record it. And I think that's probably what a lot of people do, because it can be gone, for me at least, it can be gone seconds later. And I've just missed out on something really great. I've got a cell phone full of song ideas right now. New song ideas. I have a Nord keyboard that I bought purely because I love all of the old, classic keyboard sounds. So right. It's not like I'm using a synthesizer. I'm not using it as a synthesizer. I'm using it because, I want to have, some kind of like a B3 sound or a, some kind of Yamaha synth sound or, or even a Farfisa, whatever the sound might be to inspire, that particular moment. And then I did buy a looping station this year during the pandemic. I decided to get a looping station, which I still need to take the time to master. Interestingly enough, the reason I did that is because not necessarily, I mean, at some point I will plan to use that, for myself. In whether it's performing or recording or live streaming, but mainly because I had started doing some vocal stuff. I had studied briefly with Bobby McFerrin, and he does this vocal improvisation technique, where you sing somewhat like improvisationally with people, and I'm planning to do that live on a video conference here, even as the pandemic wanes down, I'm planning to be online and do that with people. But it requires having something like a looping station in order for you to get those multiple layers of voices. So,
all right. Yeah. Now let's talk a little bit about your team, because you put together a project, you got to get it out, you got to create your buzz, and you're working with Karen Lippinger. Tell me a little bit about how that relationship began.
Karen, I didn't know Karen, but she apparently knows a lot of people that I know. It's a proof of how small the music community really is. I was working on this CD with Michael Lipton of the Carpenter Ants and West Virginia Music Hall of Fame, and he's also Mountain Stage radio show guitar, house guitarist. But he knew Karen, and when I was asking around about a publicist, and he mentioned her. And then when I met her, it turns out that she also knows a friend of mine knew the same guy that I know from Boston, from my Boston days, and she had lived in Boston. So there was a couple different connections there, with her. So, so have her for, as a publicist.
Okay. Now, we were talking earlier about how, genres were not that important anymore. And, the music industry has evolved dramatically over the course of the last 20 years, let's say. The digital revolution came in the 2000s. We went through the download stage, and now we're into this whole new world of streaming, where the consumer now consumes music differently. Not only do they consume it differently, they're listening to it differently, and they don't look at recorded music as a product. It's now a service. They can go to their phone, find pretty much any song ever recorded in the last 100 years within a flick of a finger. How has this new shift in the consumer's perception of recorded music affected you as an artist?
Well, in getting the music out there, it's certainly had a huge impact. This particular project, I really wanted to have, because there's so much history involved in it, and it's based on these stories. I wanted to have. I've got very old-fashioned with this. There's a small booklet that comes with a CD. They're packaged together. So my whole thought and what I want is that people actually listen to the music, but also read about the stories, read the history, behind it. as a different kind of experience, sort of what we may have done in the, you know, during the days of album, you know, vinyl, when we would sit in our rooms with an album and, you know, scan the booklet and the, you know, the cover to cover and the artwork and while listening to the music, you know, so, but it, you know, I knew I was choosing a medium that, you know, a lot of people don't have CD players anymore, and not even in their cars. You know, so I have had to, when the full release comes out on June 4th, you know, it will be streaming. It'll be a download. They can download the booklet if they purchase the download of the album, you know, and of course can buy the CD. But, you know, leading up to that, I did pre-release the CD itself. And it was just interesting how many people would get back to me saying, "Yeah, I don't have a CD player anymore." And it's sort of sad. You know, I find it sort of sad, but, you know, but then I'm old-fashioned. So.
Yeah. Well, yeah. And, you know, it's also interesting that not only are they consuming it differently, but they're listening it differently. I think that we're going back to what we were talking about earlier, where the genres are no longer important, you know.
They're, I hope so.
Yeah, they're well, you know, they're not curating music. They're not putting their playlist together based on an artist or based on a genre. They're doing it based on an activity or a soundtrack to their life. You know, they're creating their, you know, driving home from work playlist. Their yoga playlist. Not that I'm flexible, but, you know, it's a different mindset in how they're creating or finding the music.
And, right.
And I think what it's done is it's freed up the artist to break out of those constricting genre boxes and be allowed to create organically and be diverse in what they put out. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, I do. And, you know, some of the newer stuff that I'm writing now, you know, for my next recordings, they sound different. You know, they're probably more country swing in there mixed in with, you know, some other genres. And I probably won't, you know, they'll probably be released as singles first, you know, which is sort of a pattern. You know, this particular one that, you know, this particular release that I have coming out on June 4th, so it is sort of like a package together, you know, because the stories have, you know, sort of all come together as one cohesive message, but... Not that you can't play them separately.
No. Now, since for the last year and a half, we've been kind of shut down with touring. And, you know, prior to COVID, we were looking at Spotify and these, you know, streaming services. And we were wondering, okay, how do we now monetize this? How do we get these passive listeners to become active fans and to show up at the show and go to the merch table and pick up the merch? But COVID really kind of put a kibosh on that. But still, you have that problem that you have to stay connected to your fans. You have to expand your fan base, and you have to create those super fans, those people who will invest in your art. And a lot of independent artists have gravitated to social media, have started doing live streaming, doing content creation, which is the new buzzword. What are some of the things that you're doing to stay connected to your fans and to also expand your fan base and bring new fans into your world?
Yeah, a lot of it is, during COVID, I spent time learning to, you know, build my own website and manage my own website, learned more about, you know, social media marketing, So there was that side of it. But like I said, I bought that looping station, and you know, part of the purpose behind that is to actually be able to offer these sort of gatherings, you know, with people. I think, you know, so that more people can actually sing together, not just hear me sing. That's part of it. And then the other part is doing, I did some videos, you know, some videos of the songs on the album. Some of them we were able to get together and do, and some of them were, you know, the classic during COVID where you've got, you know, several different windows of musicians playing together. You know, I did some of those to be able to share and have the, another session coming up in May, you know, to record a couple more things so that we can live stream and do a listening party. So, yeah, all those things, it's just, you know, been a learning curve in a sense. A year ago, I would, you know, would never have, who knows if I would have been learning all these, the technology, you know,
right,
or this much of it. I don't know. I can't say I would have. I would have just been booking, you know, festivals or something, you know, and shows.
I think that this whole world of online content and content creation is going to stay with us long after the pandemic is over. And there are two benefits that I'm seeing that have appeared over the course of the last year plus of independent artists going up online. Now, of course, you know, there's a lot of noise up there. There's a lot of artists that are out there doing it, and it can get overwhelming at points. But there's two things that I've noticed that have changed the mindset of some people. The number one thing is that reality effect. You know, the reality show effect. If you look at social media, it's almost like a broadcast network. And people are allowing themselves to be looked at and have their fans have access to them on a different level. You know what I mean? They're able to connect with them, see them behind the scenes, see them what, you know, in their home environment, and almost create a sense of celebrity around them. You know what I mean? That their fans can connect to. And the other is there are several generations of potential music fans that never really grew up with that experience of going to an intimate venue and watching musicians on a stage creating in that moment.
Yes.
You know? That's
so important.
Right. I mean, that creation in the that music in the moment thing that goes on when you have musicians that are on stage feeding off each other. You know, they go to these big concert arenas and they hear the music that's just like the record. They see the choreography and the costume changes and the pyrotechnics and the lights. And it's all exciting. But that's not the real deal. That's not where music comes from. And that experience now is being brought to them in their environment, in this world of social media. So now when we do get back to touring again and someone drives by that marquee and they see that name on the marquee and they say, wow, I've seen that person on Facebook, or I've seen them live stream, or, you know, I know them from TikTok. That may entice them and entice a whole group of people to actually show up and buy a ticket and go in and experience it for themselves. What do you think?
Yeah, no, I think you're right on. I've been, you know, watching some performers that, you know, if I hadn't, you know, if I didn't go down to South by Southwest or you know, some other larger arena shows or something I never would have seen. And they're here they are in their living room or their own little home basement studio, you know, making mistakes and just being raw. I think that's been great. I just think it's so important that it makes the art more accessible to people, you know?
And it also makes the artists more accessible because they're more relatable.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? I grew up in an era, if I wanted to know what, you know, Clapton was up to, I had to get a copy of Rolling Stone and see what was written about him. You know what I mean? There was no access. You know, today, I can even access Eric Clapton's Facebook page and, you know, his Twitter account. And, you know, it's a different world.
Yes, it is.
You know, when we get out there and tour, we're going to still have one issue that we got to deal with is that whole world that we all knew, you know, those routing gigs, those small venues, the ones that paid, you know, the hotels and you know, put food in the musicians and gas in the tank. A lot of them are not going to survive. And we're going to have to rebuild touring and rebuild venue systems that we can go out and make it economical to get on the road. What kind of venues would you like to see arise out of these ashes?
Well, I would hope to have some of the ones that you mentioned, smaller venues, you know, really taking what people are experiencing, what we were just talking about, live streaming from someone's living room or their basement studio, and that same small club atmosphere. You know, I really hope that we can get some of those venues open again, you know, whether they have outdoor patios or outside, for, you know, to be outside, but also those, you know, coffee shops, small lounges, small sound stages, large sound stages, you know, because you know, you don't have to be that small to have a, you know, a black box soundstage and be very effective. I was talking to somebody locally here in the small town that I live in about this one building in town that would be ideal. We have so many people that have learned media, over the past year, and how great it would be to have a, you know, just turn that into a black box sound studio, you know, have an Austin City Limits kind of stage show, you know, and it'd be a stopping point for people coming up and down the East Coast. You know, it's, I think we have a whole ecosystem of these places and these stages. You know, we can support musicians traveling, you know, north, south, or, you know, or east, west, but, you know, there's definitely a way to do that, I think.
I definitely agree. I think that's a great idea. You know, I really appreciate you coming on the show and talking with us. It's been a real pleasure. And we're going to give everyone out there a double shot from your new release. You guys are going to love this. You may just want to turn it up loud and screw the neighbors. We're going to have some fun.
Thanks so much, Rich. I really appreciate it.
My pleasure.
Stop needing his life and the energy from his body turned to heat, and the life was taken in by other things. Daddy died here in the company store when I was just 9 years old. Mystery, a warning how it will be. We thank your union man. A mystery, a warning how it will be. We take you down to the room of lost souls. Prayer man prayed over minor bodies to be sure the evil spirit. Was it safe to look a ways? 'Cause evil can't see where to go in the dark. That's when we move them for the way. Evil can't see where to go in the dark. Evil can't see where to go. Each death a mystery, a warning how it will be. We take you down to the room of lost souls. Gotta take the dark, put it down into the light. Gotta take the dark, put it down into the light. Take the dark, put it down into the light. Gotta take the dark, put it down into the light.
Storm's coming. You can just pull up your shoes, curl up in a duvet, maybe even draw up a bath and see where the night takes you.
That sounds real nice.
Your hands. He's a sly one. He will try his tricks again and again and again. If you don't believe me, if you don't believe me at my word, if you don't believe one thing you've heard, then there's a snake in the grass, and he's ready to strike. He's a strange one, his will to deceive is worse than his bite. If you don't believe me, if you don't believe, if you don't believe one thing you've heard, then shame on you. Thank you.
There's a devil in the hills, and he's on the loose. He's a mean one, those company men have the power to abuse. If you don't believe me, if you don't believe me at my word, if you don't believe one thing you've heard, then shame on you. If you don't believe me, if you don't believe me at my word, if you don't believe one thing you've heard, shame on you. If you don't believe me, if you don't believe me at my word, if you don't believe one thing you've heard, then you're guilty too.
Whether you're an independent artist looking to take their career to the next level, or you're a fan that just loves to discover new artists and new original music, Making a Scene has exactly what you're looking for. For the indie artist, we have articles on music business, gear reviews, recording techniques, and interviews with industry professionals. For the fan, we introduce you to new artists every day with our in-depth artist interviews and insightful CD reviews. Nobody gives you more. Making a Scene truly is the number one resource for the indie artist and the fans that love them. Go to makingascene.org and become part of the indie revolution.
Shout now, honey, gonna